This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. In 2014, then Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo was elected to the presidency of Indonesia. Now, this is a man who didn't come from any political dynasty. In fact, not so long ago, he was a furniture maker in a town of 500,000 people. So how did Jokowi go from being furniture maker to mayor of Solo to president of the country in the span of about 10 years? To discuss this meteoric rise, we have on the show this morning Ben Bland, director of the Southeast Asia program at the Lowy Institute and author of a book looking at Jokowi's rise to power. It's called Man of Contradictions, Joko Widodo and the Struggle to Remake Indonesia. Ben, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Lynn.
So talk to us a little bit about the first part of the book, which tackles Jokowi's positioning as an everyman and how that perhaps fades a little bit the further up the political ladder he climbed. How much of it was reality and how much of it was clever stage management?
That's a really fascinating question, Lynn, that I think gets to one of the many contradictions of Jokowi, because he is, in some senses, the classic everyman. He came from humble beginnings, grew up in a riverside sort of shanty town in Solo, Surakarta, the city in central Java. His father was a poor bamboo hawker. Jokowi himself sort of worked his way up in life, got into a good university, studied forestry, set up his own small furniture exporting business, and eventually ran for mayor of Solo, his hometown, and climbed his way to the top by virtue of the fact that he seemed to look like and sound like and act like an ordinary Indonesian, but he seemed to be hardworking. He demonstrated that in his business as a mayor, and that was that everyman image that really projected him onto the national stage and secured him the presidency in a hotly contested presidential election 2014. But at the same time, there was obviously some kind of deeper ambition in Jokowi. There's this fox-like cunning and ability to surf the waves of electoral fortunes in Indonesia. So it's very confounding in a sense. I found trying to write this book, talking to people who know him, who work with him in business and in politics, in terms of working out what drives him, where is the real Jokowi? And that's why I came upon this idea of contradictions. It actually came from one of Jokowi's ministers. He said, well, you know, I asked him, how can I understand this man who seemingly came from nowhere, rose to the top, all this promise, but then, you know, of course, soon disappointing a lot of his many supporters. And he said, well, you know, he's a man, he's a bundle of contradictions, like many of us. And I think that's, in a way, a much easier way to start grappling with Jokowi and in some senses, Indonesia, rather than looking for one simple explanation for what sort of leader he is, or indeed, what sort of country Indonesia is.
So why is it that he retains such popularity across the country? In terms of geography as well, it's a collection of hundreds of islands. And that's one of the difficulties that presents itself when it comes to Indonesian governance. How is it that Jokowi has managed to retain this hold across the hearts of his people, even though, as you argue, he hasn't done a very great job of delivering on his promises? Is it a matter of that he is just simply different from other politicians that they've had before?
Well, indeed, it was that difference, the fact that he was the first president to emerge from outside the usual ranks of elite politicians mm-hmm. and generals and tycoons, religious leaders in Indonesia. So it was that difference, the fact that, as I said earlier, he was the guy that Indonesians would, you know, want to have a bowl of noodles with, a bowl of bakso. If George W. Bush was the guy that Americans wanted to have a beer with, although Bush didn't drink by that point. But, you know, that was how he was seen. Jokowi had that same kind of appeal to people. And although, as I said, once he's president, he's no longer been able to be so impromptu, he still travels a lot around the country. And he just has a talent for retail politics. I mean, he's made progress on some important issues. It hasn't been all bad. There's been some weaknesses. But I think it's that political skill, the ability to communicate, which is something that, you know, money can't buy. There are many people in Indonesia across the political elite who want to be president, but very few of them have that raw natural talent, which he still has, despite the limitations in a sense of connecting with people on a genuine basis when you're president. And despite, you know, the travails of office, it is, as you alluded to, very difficult to manage a country as big and as diverse as Indonesia, which is still a young democracy, only 22, 23 years since the fall of Suharto. And so I think you have to understand the context with which, you know, Jokowi and other Indonesian presidents are grappling. And it's not easy to pull this country forward. So I don't think he's doing a terrible job. And I think that's why, that's partly why people appreciate the job he's doing. They think he's trying hard, he's doing his best. And as I said, he has this ability to connect, which is, I think, just unrivaled in Indonesia.
Now, you go into great detail about the facets of his personality, which make him a good city mayor. But you also talk about the fact that those very same ones are those which eventually saw him fail to pull off the radical changes that Indonesia needs. So why do you say this? And how would you categorize him in terms of effectiveness as a leader of the country?
Well, I was lucky enough to first meet Jokowi when he was still the mayor of Solo, after I moved to Indonesia to work as a correspondent for the Financial Times. And I was lucky enough then to track his rise. So I got to know him a little bit, you know, interviewing him when he was mayor of Solo, then when he won the Jakarta gubernatorial election, and then when he won the presidency, and then when he was in the presidential palace. And I remember asking him as he went through this meteoric rise at every stage, you know, okay, Pak, you're now the governor of Jakarta, you're not mayor of Solo, a city of 500,000 people. You're running a city of, you know, tens of millions of people in the greater Jakarta area. You know, what are you going to do differently? And he said, well, nothing. I will, just like when I was city mayor, I'll go to the ground, I'll ask the people what they want, and then I'll find solutions to their problems. And I'll tell the civil servants to work hard and not be corrupt and do their job, and everything will be fine. And I was like, okay, I think that'll be difficult, but fine. And then when he was elected president, I asked him the same question. He said pretty much exactly the same answer. The only difference now is he has a plane, so he can fly around in his presidential jet across Indonesia doing his spot checks. But of course, as we've already discussed, you can't run a country like that, especially a huge country like Indonesia, so many people spread so far, with so many, you know, challenges in terms of the political system, the economy, corruption, not to mention climate change, and now, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic that's hit us all. So I think Jokowi was never really able to scale up his leadership, if you like. And I think partly because he rose so quickly, he didn't have many trusted relationships with politicians, with members of the elite in Jakarta. And I think that's made it difficult for him to set up processes for governance. So he almost, if you like, sits above the cabinet, like a bit like a king at court in the old Javanese days, and lets his ministers fight things out. And if they do a good job, Jokowi will try and take the praise for the good work they've done. If they do badly, he'll distance himself from him. But he doesn't try to kind of instill a strict governing structure from the presidential palace to coordinate policy. And I think that comes from the fact that he's just an instinctive politician. That was his genius, was an instinct for politics. But governing as a president on your instincts is not very effective. And that's why we've seen him flip-flop on a number of key policy issues. It's why we've seen him struggle to have a coherent approach to COVID-19. And in the end, I think he's someone, from a personal perspective, who rules through personalities, not through processes. And I think that's very limiting, frankly, when you're trying to be president of such a big country, and when you do have such ambitious plans to turbocharge economic growth, to build a whole new capital city in Kalimantan, in Borneo. And, you know, I think in that case, you do need better structures of government. But I think he always feared that if he had those structures, the system would control him, not the other way around.
So it's interesting that we've seen the rise of other such, as you call it, instinctive politicians and leaders around the world. An example who has recently left office would have been Donald Trump, whom no one initially expected to be able to achieve the White House. And these leaders have been called populist. Yet you don't explicitly designate Jokowi as a populist in your book, though others have perhaps described him as a soft populist. But despite the fact that you go to great lengths to illustrate his positioning himself as an outsider, as a man of the people. Do you not agree with this label as it applies to Jokowi?
Well, I'd say a couple of things there, Lynn. I mean, firstly, I think the word, the term populism is so overused right now that it's getting to the point where it doesn't really have much meaning, right? Who isn't a populist at the moment? And it reminds me of a conference that was held, I think, in the 60s or 70s at the London School of Economics, when the term was still quite new. And all these political scientists got together to discuss it. And the only thing they could conclude at the end was that no one could define what a populist was, but it was really important to keep discussing it. So I'm a bit skeptical about the use of the term. Sometimes terminology clarifies and sometimes it confuses. But certainly by most commonly accepted definitions of a populist, Jokowi doesn't fit easily. So, for example, whereas Donald Trump will often define himself as, or used to, he's now thankfully out of office, but would define himself as sort of the sole voice of the people. And anyone who disagreed with him was therefore an enemy of the people, whether they were judges or the media or Democrats or even Republicans. Jokowi is not like that. Jokowi doesn't claim to be kind of the sole representative of the sovereign will of the Indonesian people in the way that Trump did, or if you look for an Indonesian precedent, of course, Sukarno did in the years after independence. So that's one important factor. Another important factor is Jokowi doesn't, although he did rise as an outsider, he doesn't explicitly define himself against the elites. And actually, from when he first ran for the mayoralty of Solo through the governorship of Jakarta to the presidency of Indonesia, winning two great election victories in the world's biggest direct presidential election, Jokowi always worked quite well with the elites. He, of course, had this connection with ordinary Indonesians and showed himself to, through his dress, the way he spoke, to be a humble, hardworking man, and talked a lot about his roots in relative poverty in Central Java. But he also worked with elites and political parties to get nominations for elections. He worked with elites in the business community to attract investment in his various jobs, to attract funding for his campaigns. So I don't see that he's a populist in any conventional sense. He's certainly very popular, but I think that's a different question altogether.
I've been speaking with Ben Bland of the Lowy Institute, who's authored the book Man of Contradictions, Joko Widodo and the Struggle to Remake Indonesia. Up next, what the future might hold for the largest economy in Southeast Asia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Ben Bland, director of the Southeast Asia program at the Lowy Institute and author of the book Man of Contradictions, Joko Widodo and the Struggle to Remake Indonesia. So Ben, in his second time running for the presidency, there was a marked shift away from Jokowi's initially more secular roots towards more religious platforms. Was this simply a reflection of shifting public sentiment at the time, seeing as we had just recently seen Jokowi ally and Jakarta governor Basuki Cahayapurnama sentenced to 2 years for blasphemy in 2017? Or was it also Jokowi fearing that he was losing his support, perhaps reaching to garner new allies during this time?
Jokowi, like a lot of leaders, is someone who's always blown about by the winds of fortune and misfortune. So I think he's always been reactive in many respects. He's not someone who, as a student, thought much about politics. He doesn't read and never has read much about politics. He's not interested in theories and ideologies. I remember once asking him which leader he most admired, and he ummed and ahed and couldn't really think of anything, and then gave a rather perfunctory nod to Sukarno, the founding president and the father of the party matriarch Megawati Sukarno Putri, who leads Jokowi's party, the PDIP, the Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle. But he's not someone who's really interested in ideas and ideology. So I think when it comes to these questions of religion, he's really reacting to changes in Indonesian politics and in Indonesian society. I think Jokowi himself strongly comes from within this tradition of pluralism in Indonesia. He's always often worked with minorities. So his deputy mayor in Solo was a Christian, his deputy governor, and then his replacement as governor, Basuki Cahayapurnama Ahok, who was ousted from office in a sort of blasphemy controversy, was a Christian. He's just appointed a new police chief who's a Christian, who also worked with Jokowi in Solo. So I think personally, he's happy to work with all kinds of groups. Almost 100% of ethnic minorities in Indonesia voted for Jokowi in the last election, which is quite incredible. So he's someone who's reached out. But I think at times when he's felt under pressure, he has looked at various times to co-opt more radical Islamic forces when it suits him, to play up his religious background, to try and neutralize people who are saying that he's not religious enough, who are making that political argument. And at other times, he's looked to sort of neutralize some of these more radical Islamic groups, including in the last few weeks when he's, for the second time in his presidency, outlawed an Islamic group that's sort of offering, I guess, radical or conservative visions of Islam for Indonesia, not necessarily promoting violence explicitly. That there's a question mark there. there. So I think he's ultimately reactive. At heart, he's a pluralist, but I think he's willing to do, like a lot of politicians, what it takes to survive. And he's shown with these two great presidential election wins and his dramatic rise to the presidency from nowhere, that he has a really good instinct for what it takes to get into power and to survive. But I don't think that's necessarily always going to be the best thing for promoting pluralism in Indonesia. But I don't think that's ultimately what Jokowi's thinking about. You know, he would like to, but ultimately, first and foremost, he has to stay in office.
Economically, Jokowi's also made lofty promises at the start of his presidency. 7% GDP growth that has, since 2014, remained elusive, although Indonesia had consistently managed to achieve around about 5% growth. But now the country's been hit hard by the global pandemic, I mean, even falling into recession. So does Jokowi then have the strength and clarity of vision, not just enthusiasm, to bring the country back to at least its former levels of growth, if not beyond?
I think it will be a real struggle for Jokowi and for Indonesians, which is unfortunate. I mean, it's a really difficult position. Indonesia has fallen into the first recession since 1998, since the Asian financial crisis, and millions of Indonesians have lost their jobs. But more than that, there are tens of millions. In fact, most of Indonesia's workforce are in the informal sector, working as day laborers on construction sites, as delivery drivers for Grab and Gojek and other apps. And they've seen their incomes hit really hard. They don't have some of the formal protections for people who've lost formal employment. They can't work from home in the way that perhaps you or I can. So I think it's going to be a really challenging time for Indonesia. And I think I like the way you expressed it. Jokowi certainly doesn't lack enthusiasm. In fact, he's obsessed with the economic growth. He kind of brings this vision or the view of a furniture maker to building the economy, very focused on infrastructure, on simplifying business permitting processes. But he doesn't really have a broader strategic vision for how to achieve economic reform in Indonesia. And much like these religious questions from Indonesia's foundation remain unresolved, I think Jokowi is finding the same problem on the economy too, that while Indonesia in the end needs to open up its economy to become more competitive, it needs to make it easier for foreign companies to invest, easier for the Indonesian private sector to invest. But at its roots, Indonesia is quite a protectionist nation. You know, the constitution talks about natural resources being controlled by the state, etc. That talks about a family orientation to the economy, which I think is expressly in opposition to ideas of economic liberalism, which to many of Indonesia's founders, and still I think to quite a few Indonesians today, economic liberalism is seen as being as one with Western imperialism, which subjugated Indonesia, which stole its resources, impoverished its people, and gave them no opportunities. So I think it's going to be very difficult for him to come up with a clear kind of philosophy to bridge these differences between protectionism and openness. And again, coming back to this question of process, how is he going to push forward economic reform without a kind of a stronger hold on the processes of government, which as a very instinctive politician, he's just personally not interested in. And I think, as I said, fears too much process would take power away, the personal power that he has as president, away from him. So I think it's going to be a really, really difficult challenge just to get through the pandemic, let alone to get to the sort of growth he was talking about beforehand, which was 7% GDP growth a year. Indonesia was coming along at around 5%, which is not bad, but not really good enough for the 2 to 3 million young Indonesians entering the workforce every year. Indonesia wasn't creating enough good jobs for those people. So building up a lot of problems in the informal sector, and in the end, likely to fall way short of Jokowi's ambitious goal, I think, to be a developed and prosperous nation by 2045.
So in light of all of this that we've discussed then, Ben, do you think we'll ever see Indonesia take a more dominant role in the Southeast Asian region in the near future? I mean, they're the largest economy in Southeast Asia, but they're also far from a roaring Asian tiger. Is it just this protectionist inclination that is holding Indonesia back from taking that more forward stance?
I definitely think that that's part of it. I believe that if Indonesia was more economically open, it would drive higher growth, which would make it richer and give it, you know, more power. But it would also mean that Indonesia was more connected to the rest of the region and the world, and had more vested interest in driving leadership of things like the the ASEAN Economic Community, which is sort of officially now in force, but not much has really changed when it comes to things like labor mobility and investment mobility across ASEAN. So I think that, that's definitely part of it. But more than that, Indonesia is a very large country, but it's still very socially unequal. Still many tens of millions of Indonesians in and around poverty, a lot of challenges in Indonesia to keep the country together. You know, the worst separatist conflicts in Aceh has been resolved. There's still problems in Papua and elsewhere. And I think for many in the Indonesian government, ultimately their view of security is a very inward looking one. It's about keeping Indonesia together. They don't really have much time to think about sort of outward security, outward geopolitics. And then that's before we even start to get onto this question of Indonesia's foreign policy stance of being bebas dan aktif, free or independent and active, where Indonesia really wants to steer clear of being forced to choose, you know, quite like Malaysia, between any of the big camps. But, you know, that often can leave Indonesia looking more, less sort of independent and active, and I would say more passive and constrained. Because if you're so worried about being seen to be siding with anyone, it's very hard to take any big decisions. So I think, in a sense, sadly, Indonesia is likely to fall short of the ambitions that, you know, a lot of people in Indonesia, but also outside Indonesia, have for it to be a great power broker. But on the other hand, especially if you're one of Indonesia's neighbors here in Australia or in Malaysia or Singapore, maybe people should be grateful that Indonesia isn't standing up more and demanding that it be listened to as, you know, a country that has half the people of ASEAN and everything else, because that would make our lives, in a sense, maybe much, much more difficult. But I think certainly for the foreseeable future, the focus is really going to be inward. And I think that's even more so under Jokowi, because he is, as I said earlier, an economy first president. And he really views foreign policy as being subservient to economic policy. He wants it to be a tool to drive growth and jobs and investment and trade in Indonesia. And he doesn't really see a role for himself as a foreign policy leader within Southeast Asia in the way that his predecessor, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, did. So quite a different kind of leader from other leaders. But I think it's also a reflection of Indonesia's stage of development, and the fact that luckily for Indonesia, unlike Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia is broadly insulated from the South China Sea disputes. There is an area of overlapping exclusive economic zones with China in the North Natuna Sea, but there's no disputed features. And so that gives Indonesia a luxury, in a sense, I think, not to be dragged into these big geopolitical disputes for the most part, and to be able to focus on its domestic challenges, of which there are many and plenty.
So final question, Ben. Next time around, it'll be another clean slate election in Indonesia. Jokowi's limited by the constitution. He can't run for a third term. So will we see a return to the pervasive dynastic ways of Indonesian politics past? Or will Jokowi's example herald perhaps a new breed of politician? And if the latter, is there anyone that you have your eye on at this moment?
Indonesian elections are free and fair, and they do by and large decide who will lead the country. We'll have to see. And we have to remember that Indonesian politics, it is very dynamic. There are a lot of family dynasties in place who are trying to keep their hold on power. Jokowi's son and son-in-law have just won important mayoral seats in recent elections. At the end of last year, his son Gibran actually won Jokowi's former seat as mayor of Solo. So that's a pretty interesting twist that the outsider himself but now seems to be building his own dynasty. We have to remember Indonesia is a young democracy, and I think there's likely to be a number of good candidates, a number of less impressive candidates, and we'll have to see what Indonesians choose for their next leader.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us this morning, Ben. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
It's been great to be with you, Lynn. Thanks so much.
I've been speaking with Ben Bland, director of the Southeast Asia Program at the Lowy Institute and author of Man of Contradictions, Joko Widodo and the Struggle to Remake Indonesia. Now, the Southeast Asia edition of the book should be hitting bookstores in the next few months, so be sure to keep a lookout. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.